This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Jamie Mathewson. How are you, Jamie?
I'm really well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Not a problem. We're coming up to the King's coronation next weekend, and I thought this was a great chance to have a look at some of the wines that have been going on in previous coronations. Tell us, you work for Waitrose, so tell us about yourself, just briefly.
So I've worked for Waitrose for about 13 years, and I've been looking after the wine team for the last four of that. And I worked for Pier Paolo Petrassi, MW, and we look after all of drinks at Waitrose. So I look after wines. I used to look after beers, cider, spirits and soft drinks, and that's looked after by my colleague Nicola. So that's what I look after, that half of Pierre Palace drinks team.
Okay, and for our US listeners who don't know what Waitrose is, they're a supermarket, high-end supermarket in the UK.
Yeah, so we're a supermarket in the UK. We've got about 350 shops, and our competitors would be traditional supermarkets here in the UK, Marks & Spencer's, Tesco's, all the usual suspects. But then our department and where we work in drinks and wine, we have another set of competitors, the likes of Majestic, Laithwaite's, Berry Brothers, independent wine retailers, which is slightly different, I suppose, from the food side of our business.
So how do you straddle the two? Because on the one end, you've got BBR or Laithwaite's or whatever, and they've got a lot of people who know what they're talking about. And at Tesco's, you go into Tesco's and no one knows anything necessarily.
So what I say about the buyers who work for me, they've got the best and the worst job in the world. So the best job is because you're a premium wine retailer and you have all of this footfall, which is driven by all of the other stuff that we sell. So you've got people buying courgettes, mushrooms, a loaf of bread, and then we get the opportunity to sell them wine. If you're a wine retailer only, it's really difficult because you've got to get that person to think about their wine specific mission and then come and just buy wine from you. So that's a luxury we have over, say, independent winemakers. But the challenge that we have is that we compete against other supermarkets who are much, much bigger than us, have much more significant buying power. And, that is stiff competition. We compete with, German discounters who have quite a different model. So we have to compete with on lots and lots of different fronts. But that, I think, is what makes the job great, because we do have to compete on all those fronts. So that's, I think, what makes us different. I think that's what makes the job different, is that we're competing right at super premium end, Berry Brothers and Rudd, and stocking some of their wines. And we're competing right at the other end with German discounters. So it's hard. And in those 350 supermarkets, we've got around 250 beers, wines and spirits specialists who we train to WSET level 2, 3. Some have diplomas and they should be hopefully on hand. We can't unfortunately be there all the time for every hour, but they're on hand to help our customers find a wine, get a recommendation, recommendations from something they've had. If they're having a coronation party, they can get a recommendation on what they like. And so that makes us a little bit different.
Okay, cool. As I said, we're going to talk about the coronation. And the reason we're going to talk about it is one of your offsiders sent me through a list of the coronation wines. The first one was from George VI, 1937 coronation. And then we had the wines that you guys recommended for Queen Elizabeth from the 1953s. And it's really interesting looking at these old lists, because there's things that have changed, things that have stayed the same. There's quite a lot of things that are just confusing. And if you're new to wine, you probably go, I didn't even know that it happened. So it'd be great to just talk about some of the wines and some of the lists and things like that. And if we start with maybe the 1937 list, which is George VI's coronation, that'd be quite cool. So 1937, what was going on in 1937? We'd just finished World War I, about to start World War II.
Edging towards World War II, I think, at the time. Beknownst to some, unbeknownst to others. But yeah, I think that's the way we were going. But it's really interesting looking at the wine list. I would call it super premium. You've got champagne on there, you've got famous clarets, you've got first, second growths. You've got Graf, you've got Burgundies. It's a really super premium wine list. And then you've got brandies and liqueurs, some of which we'd know. So you've got Grand Marnier, you've got Hein Cognac and Martel Cognac, which we still sell today. And then other things that I wouldn't necessarily know what they are. Very fine old liqueur brandy, which I'm assuming would be slightly weaker, slightly sweeter potentially. And then Denis Meunier, a vintage 1878. So either a cognac or more likely an Armagnac. But not listed out as an Armagnac on the list. So there's so many interesting bits on there. You've got Lindeman's Sparkling Empire Wine. Lindeman's a brand that, you know, we still know and love, but I can't imagine listing a product at the moment called an Empire Wine. Grierson's Sparkling Muscatel. And then also a Dry Dominion from South Africa, a brand I just don't know, I've never heard of.
No.
And I actually don't know what the composition of the wine would be. I'm assuming it's Cap Classique, but... Who knows? So
the thing about the 1937 list, and we'll talk about the 1953 list, Queen Elizabeth's one, later on, is it looks remarkably like a modern wine list you'd get at a restaurant. That was the thing. I was surprised because I know a lot of the styles of wine that were popular back then were more fortified, but this list has got a lot of still wines, sparkling wines, dry wines, a decent sherry and port section, but not overly so.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to note the difference. We'll come on to talk about it, but the difference in fortified and sherry and how popular that became in by 53 and onwards. And here we've got much more dry styles of wine. And of course, the other thing we've got, the Mosel was hugely important,
yeah,
and popular and seen as the premium wine. And if you go there even now and go to that stretch of the river, the old family houses of the big famous names of the Lucens and the like, they are super premium. You know, that was where the money was. It was the Burgundy of the day,
yeah,
and even the Champagne of the day, revered. And of course, all the German wines disappear when you get to the 1953 list.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Some of the stuff you definitely recognise. I mean, Liebfraumilch became a bit of a dirty word at the time. Super premium.
I know. If you look at the pricing, because everything's in shillings and pence, and it took me a wee while to work out the conversion rates. I must admit, so just for the listeners at home, in the old system, it was 20 shillings to a pound and 240 pence to a pound. You're right. If you look at the Liebe wines, Liebfraumilch, one came in at, you know, I'll give you the modern price of it, 29 pence. And if you compare that to a sort of third growth Bordeaux, a Chateau Laranger, at 33 pence, you know, you're going Liebe is almost the same price as a third growth Bordeaux. And that's pretty good going.
I mean, by today's modern standard, Liebfraumilch goes for, at the low end, between £4 and £5 in a UK supermarket. Third growth Bordeaux of a decent vintage.
40, 50?
Yeah. I mean, not £4 anyway.
No.
You know, it's just changed so dramatically. And in that time, so is the sweetness. You know, the sugar levels have changed in the German wines. And I think in the meantime, you've got mechanisation, you know, stainless steel tanks and production, the volumes you could get through in order to sell to a market. Whereas the production method in Bordeaux, pretty similar to what it would have been back then in terms of cask and cask management. So lots of things have changed in the meantime, which affect the price. But the popularity of those wines and their acceleration and the relative price back then is really fascinating.
Yeah. The other thing I notice is there's a lot of the wines have the shipper in there, you know, ship by blah, blah, blah. And that is because I think back then a lot of the wines were shipped by in cask to the merchant or whoever was buying it and then bottled locally.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about now how we go about sourcing wine via email and then EDI and then, you know, everything scanned to know where the stock is, how someone's been paid, you know, paying at the speed of light. If you compare it to that back then about how you would find a contact, how you would get the source, how you would make sure it was legit, how you would ensure that the shipment arrived, how you'd then pay for it, foreign currency. I mean, it is just quite remarkable. So there were many, many more stages in the supply chain back then. And you had to do, there was a huge amount of different checks and balances that would have to be made along the way. And one of the main differences was obviously buying in what was called bulk back then, but that would be buying a cask and then ensuring you had a bottler over here. And you would get a wine merchant to do that. So if you had a reputable wine merchant as your exporting bit, and you had a reputable wine merchant as your importing bit, and then you had a reputable bottler, that meant a lot. That meant you could effectively charge a premium and say, I know where the wine comes from and I can guarantee the quality, because that was seen as quality in that cask. There was a lot of wine on the market, I suspect, that was sold as a product that it might not have been.
Yeah, I bet there was. I bet there was indeed. And interesting you're saying about that, you know, bulk shipping, bottled locally. With the introduction of appellations in France and all that type of thing, that process changed quite a bit. And even now, if you try and buy a Chianti, it's got to be bottled in Chianti, because they just don't trust the shippers. You know, there must have been so much fraudulent material that the when the regulations came in, they absolutely had to explicitly state that those wines had to be bottled at source, so that they could control that.
100%, and that still exists today. So I think it was in 1935 that appellations came in France. So that was only 2 years before this wine list was produced. And that's really when things started to change. And a lot of those rules implemented back then, we absolutely still have today, like bottling at site. And the thing that's changed, I suppose, is the efficiency that there is or isn't, and also the carbon, you know, that's involved in producing on a bottle, shipping empty bottles. You ship a lot of fresh air because bottles don't tessellate very well, especially when they're full, and then moving that from all over the world. Of course, not a huge amount of New World wine on here back in the day. And then you think about the volumes that we now get from, you know, South America, which just doesn't feature on the list at all. And the New World, quote unquote, that does exist is from Australia and South Africa for obviously colonial reasons.
But also South Africa was making wine, it's one of the oldest New World countries that have been making wine for donkey's years. I think it was something like 1600s, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And you see 1650 on the buildings, all the old Dutch buildings that you get in Stellenbosch. Yeah, they've been making wine for a long, long time over there. And it just, I mean, it's an interesting point, isn't it? They've been making wine for a long time, and dependent on the history of the country, where the market is, it's then where that's then exported to.
Well, let's have a quick look at 1953. This is Queen Elizabeth's coronation. And here, the wine list has changed dramatically. This is the sort of wine list I was actually expecting from the 1930s, to be honest, because you look at it and there's a lot of spirits on the list. It's not all wines, is it? But there's a lot of fortified wines, isn't there? I mean, it's just amazing how many fortified wines. And almost hardly any normal dry wines.
Exactly. And I think the Second World War, you've still got rationing in 53. And, you know, interestingly, it's got a large box on it saying some inexpensive sherry and table wines. Mm. And it's moved from what I would call, you know, super premium, you know, class growth, Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne. It's moved to loads more fortified, lots of British wine and inexpensive sherry and table wines. So you've got, you've still got a Saint-Emilion on there, but you've also got Hungarian Riesling. Yes. And again, they're priced the same, which I think is really fascinating. So, and you've got an Italian Red Tuscan.
Yep.
So if you compare, you know, Super Tuscans now to Hungarian Riesling, again, you'll be paying a really, really different price.
Yeah.
It's obviously designed to pique the interest of those looking for value. And it was a tough time. You know, 53 was a tough time. And people were looking for value and they were looking for a small treat, which was really different from what we see in 37, which was kind of more bourgeoisie, I would say. You know, there were some posh wines on there.
Do you think the like one of the things that we've seen as times progress is wine started out very niche-y, and then over time it got expanded into larger and larger demographics within society, and now it's, I wouldn't call it completely mainstream, but it's fairly mainstream product, whereas maybe in 1937 they were less mainstream perhaps?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the one thing that we haven't talked about is beer. You know, beer was only overtaken by wine in the UK in 2005. in terms of sales. So beer was the drink for almost all families in 37 and also 53. And the pub offered a completely different environment than it does now. So being able to get 3-course, 5-course, 7-course meals in pubs with a long wine list, that just simply wasn't the case in 53 or 37. They were for beer drinking.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they were for. So actually, this was really competing with beer.
The reason, one of the reasons beer was so dominant was because it was a cheap product that was safe to drink, whereas water back then, well, not 37, well, maybe 37, but certainly, you know, 50 years, 100 years earlier, water was very dodgy to thing to drink, whereas beer was a safe product because the alcohol killed off a lot of the bugs, so to speak.
Yeah.
Cool. If we look at some of these wines, and I love that there's an Empire wine list, and it, as you said, it's like 37 in that there's South Africa and Australia, and whilst you don't really think of Emu brands these days, it is still there and owned by Accolade. I had a look, and it's owned by Accolade Wines now,
yeah.
So it's still out there doing its thing. But again, all of them here are all sherries and ports or that style of thing, which you don't see a lot of. I mean, there is some sherry and port styles that you see these days.
Weestock is an old, they call it an old boy's tawny. 21, yeah. But they call it tawny.
Do
yeah.
they? That's interesting.
Yeah, but not tawny port.
No. Okay.
Yeah, what I love in that list is the Emu and Harvest Burgundy, which
yes.
the Burgundians would have something to say about the now. And then also the Three Crown brand, so a mix of tawny, white and sherry. I mean, that would have been a pretty interesting drink, I would imagine. Tawny white and sherry.
Yeah.
And then you've got, you know, Emu 333, 444 and 999 port style, which I presume people knew what that meant. I don't. So yeah, and you know, SAWFA's Onza Rust South African sherry. And you just don't see South African sherries on the lists anymore.
No.
It is still produced, but it's relatively small quantities.
Okay, so if we look at the wine list here, some of the differences in terms of things like pricing. I had a look at the average price of the sparkling wines from 37 to 53, and the price went up from, on average, for a bottle of champagne, 60 pence a bottle to £1.50 a bottle, roughly in modern terms, because it's all in shillings and pence, which is Dutch to everybody. So the inflation wasn't really huge in that 15 years. It was like, what, two times, just over doubled, which normally you sort of expect prices to double every 10 years as a typical inflation, I would have thought. But now, where are we now? What's a bottle of Black Label Lanson, you know?
40 quid.
Yeah, 40
around
quid.
Around there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's changed quite significantly. It's and again, these were luxury items. These are super luxury items. So I think the team at the time must have been caught betwixt and between wanting to offer a really super premium product, but knowing it's an absolute luxury, and trying to, you know, compete and make sure it had the appropriate price so it wasn't beyond the reach of absolutely everyone. And it's interesting in the opening salvo, it says, wine drinking with meals at home can be as cheap as drinking the highest strength beers. And it's obviously competing with, you know, getting your beer at the pub and then saying spend a similar-ish amount, but take it home rather than buying wine in the on-trade, which still would have been, you know, really expensive at the time and reserved for proper restaurants.
Now, just on this, one of the things I noticed was that we think of Waitrose when we think of John Lewis partnership, and has Waitrose always been part of John Lewis, or did John Lewis buy Waitrose?
John Lewis bought Waitrose.
When did they buy them?
So Waitrose was bought by the John Lewis partnership. We had 10 shops at the time, and we were bought by John Lewis in 37, the year of the coronation. Yeah. And then we opened our first kind of full service supermarket, what you would think of a supermarket as today, rather than a serviced shop, in 55.
When you say service shop, that's like you go up to the guy on the counter and they go and get the product for you.
Exactly. I would like a Fletcher of bacon. You wear it out for me. This is what I'd like, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, I noticed on the 1953 one, you've got your licensed branches, John Lewis Partnerships, licensed branches, and it mentions John Barnes and Company, Waitrose Limited, and Schofield and Martin Limited. And they've only mentioned 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, about 12 branches that are licensed. Was everything, not everything was licensed back then, or?
So certain shops had a license and others didn't. And so you could only purchase alcohol to take off the premises from those ones which had a license. So you had to, if you wanted those wines, you specifically had to go to those shops. And then, and even then, I think it says on the list, if the wine is not available in that shop, speak to the branch manager. He will collect it for you from the shop where it is available. Come back and get it for you.
Yeah, that's...
yeah. I could do without these days, to be quite honest.
Yeah. Okay. So I think the big difference is the wines have changed in style. They've become a lot more fortified between 37 and 53. Do you think that was because more people were looking for a sweet treat, because sugar is quite still reasonably expensive back then, and fortified wines give you that rush of sugar, and it's like anything, when you're in austerity, you really crave a treat? Or do you think it was maybe the masses moving into consumption and going for these higher strength fortified products?
Do you know, I think it was probably both. I think there's definitely an element of a sweet treat, because we see... you know, exports from Spain of sherry into the UK get really driven by sweetness. So Harvey's Bristol Cream, Croft Pale Cream, which is not something you will find anywhere in Spain, but was driven by the British market, which is Fino sherry sweetened,
yeah.
which is a bizarre thing in Spain. They wouldn't know why you would do it. But that became huge in the UK. And I think that is driven by sweetness. And it became really popular in the Victorian era, you know, sweetened pale cream and rich cream sherries. And I think people were looking for that treat. Also, I think there might have been a pence per alcohol element going on. You know, if you're going to have one glass, do you want something at 20% or do you want something at 3-4%?
Yeah.
So that I think the relativity of the amount of money you're having to spend for the alcohol was definitely a feature.
Waitrose have done this list for a couple of coronations. Do you have one for this coronation?
We don't have a specific list that we're publishing in the same way, as much as I would love to. I think one of the main things that would stop us from doing that, we now carry about 1,400 wines, and there's a lot on there, and there's a lot of breadth in terms of style, in terms of price point, and all the rest of it. So picking out a couple of recommendations would be really, really tricky. So that's the first thing. And then I think things have changed so much since 53 and 37, so much. And I think people live in such a different way and celebrate in a different way that I think to suggest that it's a celebration, therefore people open champagne or have, Madeira was the drink of the day before every meal. And that, you know, that doesn't feature nearly as much on people's palates. To suggest that, you know, everyone should drink champagne, I think there'll be lots of people who say, that's not for me. I want to drink Prosecco. You know, Prosecco doesn't feature on either of these two lists, and yet is one of the largest, biggest selling wines in the UK by a long stretch. So I think the list would be really, really different today. And I suppose the biggest difference is probably instead of British made wine on here, which was maybe some questionable juice coming from France and Spain and then being sweetened with rectified grape must over here, I think English wine and Welsh wine is in a totally different place now, because, you know, the plantings that happened early 60s, 70s, we've got really fantastic quality English sparkling wine now.
Yeah, the thing about it is, though, that the coronation is, it's in England, but it's a coronation for the Commonwealth, really. If you look at how many countries are still part of the Commonwealth, I had a quick look at the countries that will have Charlesy as the monarch that make wine are Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and now the UK. So there's still... Oh, and not South Africa anymore. No, not the South Africans. They've given up on that. So there are still quite a few countries that you could get the wines from and have a proper coronation rather than using a lot of sort of European styles where the king isn't...
Yeah, that's certainly true. That's certainly true. And it's funny, you know, when you look at champagne on both lists, that does seem to be a bit of a timeless drink, actually. And even the brands, you know, you've got the same brands in 37, 53 that you get on the shelves today. So it's interesting how that has survived, and the way that they protected that has done so well. And also the premium that you have to pay for champagne. There does seem to be a correlation between premium fine wines and longevity. I think, you know, well-made premium wines from the right areas seem to stand the test of time.
What, well, Lieberfeldmarsh?
Still here with us. Do you know, it's funny, I was in Germany recently, and it's fun. If you say Lieberfeldmarsh to a new generation drinkers, it doesn't mean anything to them.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most pretty corners of the world, actually. So I wouldn't be surprised if it makes a comeback, you know. So I think Lieberfeldmarsh will make a comeback. Whether it charges the same price as second-class Bordeaux ever again, I'm not so sure, but...
Just a recommendation for coronation quiche. What do you recommend?
Ooh, coronation quiche. I mean, it would be remiss of me not to offer an English sparkling, right? I think English sparkling wine's a pretty good match for a quiche, actually. If you've got richness, some cheese, some egg, actually, I think an English sparkler will do quite nicely there. The bubbles be nice, cleanse your palate a bit, and a nice bit of sharpness to combat the richness of the quiche. I think that would be great. So why not open a bottle of Nightimber English sparkling? They've got a special coronation pack as well.
I'm sure they have. Cool. All right, then. I think we'll wrap it up there, Jamie. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.